Welcome, my name is Michael Stoppard and I'm delighted to welcome you to this CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Market. Our topic today will be to look at the global gas market. So global gas, as with other commodities, is being buffeted by events, by the COVID crisis, by the contraction in global GDP, and also influenced by the reduction in oil prices. The task we have set ourselves today is what lies ahead, and we'll look at that. We'll try to look through some of the fog and some of the uncertainties and think about what the drivers are for the future of the gas industry. I'm delighted to be joined by two regulars at CERAWeek. You will have heard them speak before at previous CERAWeeks, I'm sure. So first of all, I welcome Hendrik Gordenka, Director and Senior Advisor with JERA, the Japanese utility and one of the world's largest LNG importers, of course. And we also welcome Laurent Vivier, President of Global Gas with Total. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. I hope you're well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us on this new format. Just before we get stuck into what's going on in the global gas industry, I thought it would be nice, given that we're in different locations and we're very international, just to get a sense of what's going on in your local areas. And if I can start with Hendrik, how are things over there in Japan?
Well, it's been a fascinating period here. And really, I'm very proud of how the Japanese people as a whole have responded to this crisis. First, the Japanese government actually has very limited authority to order lockdowns, to tell businesses to shut down, to do the things that you see in some other jurisdictions. It's just all the government can do is request cooperation and good behavior. And in general, people have really responded and are acting, very responsibly, and applying good habits of clean hygiene that are deeply ingrained in the culture here. So the result is that actually the health impact of the virus is relatively low in Japan. We had a brief resurgence, but today's report was there were a total new diagnoses of coronavirus in Tokyo, 9 million people, five diagnoses. So we're getting to the point now where the government is going to advise on how to relax and how people can move into the next phase. But very emphatically, people say, we're not going back to what it was. Everybody has to learn a new way of working, a new way of life. We have to adapt to this new situation, and we're going to make lasting changes. So very interesting.
That's very interesting. And Lauren, where are you joining us from today? Are you in France?
Yes, I am in Paris. The situation, as in most European countries, we are getting slowly, and I would say very slowly, out of this lockdown period. People are coming back to work extremely slowly, just to be very honest. There's still a nervousness that you can sense in France. We have offices in Switzerland and in London, and we do have the same kind of feedback. Definitely, this lockdown period of more than 50 days is going to leave some traces in terms of attitude, some positive ones. I guess working at home would not be considered as not working anymore. some good ones, maybe some more difficult ones to overcome in terms of bringing everybody back to work. So it's a slow process. I must say everybody's nervous now about what could happen in the afterward, second wave, not second wave, whatever. What is apparent is that people have changed in terms of how they live their ordinary life. So definitely I'm still quite optimistic about it. Very interesting times, as Hendrik was saying. Challenging ones, I would say. I'm sure we'll talk about it. But I would say the 2 or 3 weeks to come will be a real test about our ability to come back to a sense of normality.
Yes, and I think in London and the UK, we're just a little bit behind, a week or two behind what's going on in continental Europe. But I know that our Prime Minister has joked and has commented that he's been very surprised that it's actually been easier to take away liberties than to hand them back, as he the unlocking of the lockdowns and one of the surprises going on. We should turn, gentlemen, to developments in the gas market. I think we all know that the market is going through a certain degree of turmoil and relatively low prices. Hendrik, as you assess this from your vantage point in the Asia Pacific, how would you summarize the performance of the market at the moment?
Well, we went into this crisis period with plentiful LNG supplies coming to Asia, and then have had on top of that a significant drop in demand. So it's a period where there's a lot of LNG available at very low prices, and there's a challenge in managing long-term commitments to LNG. That's sort of the big picture in Asia. At the same time, we see some movement, some positive movements. China is beginning to come out of the lockdown and resume economic activity. There's significant demand appearing there. I expect we'll see that in some other places. Low prices for LNG have indeed stimulated some demand, and I think maybe have gotten some people to give LNG another look. Lots of challenges, I would say, also operational challenges, just managing in this crisis. And so far, at least in the LNG sector, generally not huge destruction, and maybe some pinpoints of light coming through the tunnel.
Okay, and Lauren, what would be your observation?
I think it's I think we are slightly behind in the recovery. Even if we can sense, I would say, in the gas demand, we can sense some things changing a bit in terms of slopes and recovering to normal levels. In some countries, we ended up a formal lockdown in two weeks ago, for example. Already in France and Italy, you can sense in terms of gas demand something which is coming back to normality. Slowly, but it's better. So there is some optimism there. Definitely, there was a massive crash of the demand. Roughly 20% of the gas demand has been impacted during the month of April. So it's going to leave some traces. Storage is extremely high as a consequence. As we still have received a kind of, I would say, very healthy flows of LNG, which were directed away from Asia, were coping with an increased supply. So definitely a lot of supply, very abundant. This demand destruction during the month of April. Hopefully, we will have reached the bottom by during this month of May with a possible shift in terms of trends. North America was badly hit as well in terms of gas demand, roughly 10% during the month of April, which for such a large country is massive in terms of the overall worldwide balance in terms of gas. So definitely, I would say a strong impact, today more severe, and with still some uncertainties compared to Asia, as Hendrik was talking about.
As we are assessing demand, we're finding it very challenging and complex to understand that interaction between GDP and economic expectations and gas and power demand. What would you reflect on that, Noel?
I think the GDP is definitely playing a role in the gas demand. We have increasingly a balance, let's be very honest, which is made in the LNG market by the power sector in Europe. It is the power burn on CCGTs in Europe, which is rebalancing an LNG market, which we've known for quite a few months now to be slightly in excess. So that is linked to GDP. At the same time, the overall balance and the price drivers for the LNG market are still largely dictated by the arrivals, which are usually dictated by FIDs made 5 years before in terms of supply with very low OPEX. So this supply is continuing, whatever the price, roughly. We will see maybe in the US where there might be a rebalancing, but definitely the GDP will play a role. But we know that in the overall balance in the LNG market, it's not the biggest driver.
Yes. And Hendrik, what's your view on looking at how GDP and economics is impacted to demand? Has there been a breakdown in the models?
The way that markets have behaved has not been entirely expected. I think there are factors beyond GDP that are operating here. you know, just a, you know, a couple of examples. We do see with the current pricing circumstances and also with some policy shifts happening, some coal to gas shifting in the power generation sector. The role of renewables has really been a key one in this crisis, as renewables have really gained significant scale and also tend to be dispatched first. Then, you know, how do you absorb the downtimes for renewable energy production? And, you know, the flexibility of gas has been important there. And, you know, that has really emphasized the role of gas. In Asia, there's also some of the factors of how contracting is done that make a big difference. LNG is often sold under long-term take-or-pay contracts, so it's not that easy to just turn down the supply. I think we'll actually see continuing impact from that. Pricing, for example, pricing based on the Japan Crude Cocktail JCC, quite a few long-term contracts use that as a price basis. That tends to lag, you know, current market prices by, you know, between 4 and 6 months. So we've had very low crude oil prices for a period, and the impact of those low crude oil prices on the gas price hasn't even come to us yet. So it's going to be very interesting to watch how that develops.
Well, I think you spoke about low prices stimulating demand. So I wanted to explore that, particularly if we know that contract prices have not even fed, will feed through over the next 4 to 6 months. Did you want to expand on how low prices are offering new opportunities?
Well, in some markets, the low prices are not offering all that much opportunity because demand has fallen away. So it would be nice to be able to buy and use LNG at that price, but don't need it. So you have a certain amount of that. But there are some places where you've seen, for, you know, as I mentioned, coal to gas switching, where that can really operate. I guess looking a little bit further along as we see global markets moving in response to you know, varying patterns of recovery from COVID, and there will also be some impact in terms of development of new projects and supplies coming online, some impact on maintenance schedules. As we move through this period, I think global trading is going to play a significant role in terms of balancing out the supplies. If you have long-term contracted quantities at very competitive prices compared to, say, the spot LNG coming out of the U.S., you know, that could be a brand new dynamic. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I think we really need to be ready for. That dynamic can really play out because there's quite a lot of shipping capacity available. And, you know, the ships can be used for covering distances and also as temporary storage and cover time. So it's going to be a complex game over the next, you know, over the remainder of this year and probably longer, as we see all of the pieces of the puzzle start to fall into place.
Laurent, do you think that the industry has shown itself to be flexible in this crisis? Where are we in terms of flexibility and the interaction between long-term contracts and the spot market?
I think we are progressing, I would say, faster than anybody would have thought a few months ago. Are we there yet? No, of course. And I think Hendrik was mentioning, for example, the rigidities which come in terms of pricing from long-term contracts. They do impact the ability of the market to rebalance through a price mechanism. At the same time, we are now really seeing some areas of flexibility to price, reactivity to price, sensitivity to price. We know Europe, with, of course, the competition in terms of power generation, which does create an incremental demand where there is a proper price signal. We've seen it in India, because we forget that before the lockdown, India imported massively as a reaction of lower prices, which were coming from earlier lockdown phases in other countries in Asia. And India proved an extremely good outlet for LNG cargoes, which could not go to the Far East. So that's another pocket of flexibility. We've seen China And if the massive recovery of, not massive, but what we see today as an increase of China in terms of LNG demand, which is now putting China year on year for the last month, now in positive signs, which was not the case before. So we are back to a growth scenario. It is partly due to a reaction to low LNG prices, which are displacing apparently some flows for pipe gas. So there is an increasing level of flexibility on the demand side. Just three examples, and China, India, Europe. Henrik was talking on the supply side as well. It is happening, where at last we have some supply which can be interrupted when prices fall really below a certain level. And
we know you're thinking of what there? You're thinking
the US,
US export. The US market.
So we now have both on the supply and on the demand so mechanisms to adjust faster than before, a supply-demand balance, which before took a few months and maybe years in order to readjust.
Henrik, how do you view security of supply during this crisis when you look at the supply side? Has that changed thinking in Japan?
Well, I don't think there's been a huge change in thinking, but our top priority has been to make sure that our people are safe and the people working with our project partners and our counterparts are safe and can operate with continuity. We've so far had good results on that, but it's an area that requires constant attention until the coronavirus issue is somehow resolved. The market was already amply supplied, and we haven't seen any significant disruptions. So it's not really a big problem issue. But I guess there are factors that we haven't had to look at before concretely. And we all have challenges and opportunities in how to work those out. I think that the most important new factor is one that Laurence just mentioned, which is the supplies coming out of the U.S. actually, there is an option for a toller to cancel cargoes. And that's a new kind of flexibility that comes at a fairly short term and also is readily quantifiable right up front. And so this offers a way to you know, predictably calculate what the most efficient way to manage a portfolio when you're in a slightly oversupplied situation.
Does it imply that a U.S. swing is a more efficient way of managing than storage in market? I mean, storage in Northeast Asia is an expensive undertaking.
Well, I don't think we have all the answers on that question. And I think that we probably need more than one mechanism to deal with the fluctuations in supply and demand. We may come back to this. You know, coronavirus is not the first thing to disrupt our world, and we, you know, we may have more. We need to have a full toolbox with lots of mechanisms, both on the seller side and the buyer side, and in between on the transportation and the trading side, to manage an increased level of volatility.
Okay. I think I'd like to move us along to think about how you invest in this kind of environment and what it means for the medium term. Everyone's interested in what's happening to FIDs, final investment decisions on projects. Can you share with us some of your experiences about how companies think about making final investment decisions in this environment and what you think the prospects are over the next 12 to 24 months?
I think, well, firstly, we are witnessing today the end of construction, the start of operations of the previous big wave of FIDs, mostly in the U.S. Train 3 Freeport is now closing the period of this first wave of U.S. projects. Well, amazingly, we are talking about changes of models in the LNG industry. There's one thing which apparently has not changed, whether it is a U.S. project or Mozambique project or an Arctic project, is the commitment either of shareholders or of buyers to, on a long-term basis, in order to finance the project. I'm not aware of any project so far, despite the increased liquidity of the market, which has taken an FID without this security in terms of offtake for at least a decade. The current environment makes it more difficult. Let's be very honest. The industry is used to taking a long-term view. Still, we are today in a Brent environment which is much lower, which brings down the revenues of liquids, which are usually considered as a very essential complement of LNG when you have some rich gas. So the economics definitely would be, I think, looked at even more carefully than before. It's not going to speed up FID decisions. And I don't see a lot of buyers. Maybe Henrik, I'd be glad to discuss with Henrik just after this phone call, if I confirm that he's ready to commit straight now to massive volumes of purchase. But I don't think it's the case. And I think both buyers and sellers are going to enter an area of a bit turbulence, and we will be more cautious on both sides in terms of long-term commitments.
So, Henrik, what can you share with us? Can the buyers afford to help finance and promote the next generation of FIDs?
The economics today look very challenging, but we all need to look at these projects in the longer term. And what does the longer term picture look like? Well, there's still a lot to sort out. So I think it's going to take some time to get to the same pace of development that we have had. I mean, maybe we will not get to that pace again for a long time or ever. But I do think that we've seen in this crisis that natural gas has played a structural role in providing energy in many places. That's certainly true in Japan, and you can certainly see that around Asia. Where that structural role exists, and where it can be strengthened by confidence in robust supplies and in competitive pricing, that lays the groundwork for future FIDs and further project development. For the near term, I wouldn't look for a huge amount of action, but I'm cautiously optimistic that we can do this right. The one thing that I think is incredibly important is not to fall into a pattern of just doing nothing for too long and getting into a situation of undersupply, and then ending up with very high prices and spoiling demand. We need, as an industry, to provide a long-term, stable relationship between supply and demand.
We would like to avoid those cycles. Is it possible, do you think, to avoid those cycles or to mitigate them?
Well, I think we're in a better position than we used to be because there's much more confidence in the technology. There's more confidence on the financing side. We're getting to a point where market price indicators are more reliable. They're not bankable yet, but we can talk about commoditization. And we're getting to a place where financial commitments can be made not based on 100% long-term commitments, but some lesser percentage, and the market can fill in the rest. So I think we're making a lot of progress. Also, it's just a bigger pie. So adding incremental pieces is not as tough. And we have lots of opportunities to add increments by debottlenecking and project expansions and refitting projects. So I think we have a lot of tools available to do a better job on balancing supply and demand.
Very good. I'd like to finish by, I'm really taking a longer term view, discussing the future of the energy transition and the role that gas and renewables will play in that. And in fact, I think in the last 24 hours, Lauren, your company has announced taking a wider position in the Spanish gas and power market. You have a similar position there. You're building up a gas position. Is this a model of the gas and renewable partnership?
I think definitely we cannot afford to slow down. And I think that's it comes from a pressure from various stakeholders, whether it is our customers, whether it is the government we are talking to. If ever this crisis has is going to accelerate, I think the our drive to move and embrace this energy transition and be an actor of it. What you are seeing in Spain is exactly a complement to what we've done in other countries, in liquid countries, in France, for example. We have a few CCGTs now in operations. We've gone into the B2B and B2C markets in Europe. And I think that the idea of this continuity of our presence along the value chain, which is increasingly important. When we see the price of a barrel of oil shifting in just a few weeks from 60 to 30, you do see that the value is shifting quickly, maybe even faster than before, all along this value chain, but going backwards and forwards. So it's absolutely essential that we are present everywhere. And I think we can put what I think is still the financial might, the technical expertise of IOCs to the service of this energy transition. We are investing a lot of money. It's close to 10 billion which have been invested by Total now. We are hoping at the end of of this decade to bring all our capital employed, roughly 20% in this low carbon economy, which is renewables or gas fired generation. But definitely we will not slow down.
I think so, a continued commitment and not slowing down from an international oil and gas company. And Hendrik, do you see the drivers still very much in place for the energy transition? Are you concerned about affordability?
Well, affordability has been one of the challenges for LNG in Asia. And maybe we see some opportunities with new business models coming out, new additional competition and greater confidence that we can supply LNG at competitive prices. I think another important lesson of the last few months is that renewable energy sources have generally performed quite well. They've done very well for the producers and the consumers of the energy. They've done quite well for the financial investors. And that there is policy backing that has contributed to that outcome, but all in all, people, I think you can look at this and say, yeah, actually, renewables make good sense. You come into a crisis and you have very low marginal cost energy. That's a good thing. We now know that it's so nice to have clean air and having energy sources that produce that. That's a good thing. So I think that there is certainly momentum in terms of going to clean energy. And certainly from a JERA perspective, we think that the way to get there faster is by partnering renewables and LNG. So we will certainly be continuing along those lines. And today, there's still so many uncertainties, and it's difficult to get on the ground and look at some of the things that you want to look at before you go ahead with the project. But a lot of the building blocks are falling into place, and we have a real opportunity where, knock on wood, humankind overcomes the coronavirus challenge, and then we can really tackle a new form of energy provision and energy transition.
Well, thank you for that, Hendrik. I think that's an excellent place at which to end our conversation. I mean, one of the takeaways that I certainly have is a sense of actually the resilience that we've shown from the supply side, which shouldn't be taken for granted, and how well we've been served. And I'm also struck by the consensus that we've heard from both the producer and the consumer that the drivers for a gas renewable energy transition are still very much in place. The future's not being cancelled, as someone once said. Gentlemen, thank you very much for giving up your time, sharing your latest thoughts with us here at CERAWeek Conversations. And for everyone listening, thank you for joining us for this CERAWeek Conversation presented by IHS Markit. Thanks very much. Bye.